Call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. First order of business, the minutes.
Representative Christensen. Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Christensen moves the minutes of March the 10th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. We have four bills again today. First one is Representative Norton. And no rush, just take your time. I would like to point out to members of the committee that there is a handout that goes with this testimony, and I believe you'll find it at the kind of on the bottom of your stack. Everybody here understand? Okay. Welcome to your committee, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I didn't hear, did you move House File 15?
Oh, I did not. But you can.
I could do that. I'll move House File 1517 to be laid over for possible inclusion, I believe.
That is correct. Now you can begin.
Thank you. Well, members, we've had lots of great presentations so far this year, and we have another one yet today. But one of the things that became very clear as we've been hearing much of the testimony and feedback from both Minsk and the university and the Department of Higher Ed is that our schools costing, our colleges and universities are costing our students and their families a great deal of money, that graduation is not happening for enough of our students, and it's taking too long, which increases the cost. So before you, you have a bill that tries to set up a framework and asks both Minsk and the university to develop a comprehensive plan to encourage students to complete their college or field of study, two-year, four-year, in the time that one would expect. And unfortunately, I'm afraid what one would expect now, really accepted that it takes students longer than 4 years or 2 years, and I just don't think that's reasonable given the cost. So this this particular bill asks the board to consult with students, faculty, and administrators in developing a plan. And the plan has many components, including looking at decreasing the need for developmental and remedial courses, not necessarily getting rid of them completely. That may not be reasonable, but looking at co-requisite courses, intrusive advising and trying to catch students before they go down a path or take a course that, for instance, doesn't give them credit, that someone stops them and there's either a person or a software in place that would stop them to say, whoa, if you take this course, it isn't going to count and it won't transfer, and stop them before it happens rather than after. That we look at meta majors, which is maybe a large area of study. So if you think you might want to go into a major, and I can give you an example, the University of Minnesota in Rochester has a health sciences major. And every student, no matter what the major, their end major is when they get there, all take the exact same first 2 years of coursework. And at that time, they may have declared a major, and they may not have at that point. But even if they change majors within the field of health sciences, all their credits count. And then they just shift from one to the other their third and fourth year. And it's been successful, and we want to see that type of meta major category perhaps being used in other colleges and universities. Offering students mathematical curriculum that's tailored to their course of study rather than one-size-fits-all math. And we know that math is one of the areas that students come to us with different degrees of skill. And perhaps everyone doesn't need algebra, or as a precursor to their job, they may need a different type of math. And so we're going to ask the colleges and universities to look a little closer at that. Automatically registering students for, as I said, with the University of Minnesota Rochester for a certain class, and then they can deviate from that, but that there will be a set course of action for them to take, and then if they actively choose to deviate from that, they would have an advisor to help them decide to do that. We want to continue to work on the transfer issue, which we all know and this committee has dealt with for years if you've served on that. And really, the bottom line to all of this is to help students to be able to who are enrolled to enroll full-time and to take 15 credits, because that is what it takes for a student to be able to graduate on time, particularly in the four-year colleges and universities. There was a wonderful example given at a conference, and the conference I went to was Complete College America with because the state of Minnesota is one of the 37 states? 35 states that participate in Complete College. And they gave the example of a room full of students, and the person asked, how many of you are going to college, and how many of you are planning to graduate in 4 years? And everybody raises their hand. And then they said, how many of you are taking 15 credits? And very few of them raised their hands. Because that's what's really happened. Is students don't understand and aren't being directed that if you want to graduate and have the best use of your money, you really do need to go full-time. And that means 15 credits, not 12. So I think I'm going to stop. I have a few other points here I could make, but I think maybe the presentation that you're going to quickly see here will help with several of the bills and kind of frame the discussion a little bit further, and then I'm happy to answer any questions afterward that you may have about the proposal before you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. And your testifier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton and the committee, my name is Bruce Vandell, and I am from Complete College America. And it's a pleasure to be with you today. Particularly, I'm a born and raised Minnesotan, graduated of the University of Minnesota, and actually cut my teeth on education policy issues working with one of your colleagues, Representative Mariani, at Minnesota Minority Education Partnership several years ago. So it is really very exciting to be here today talking to you about these important issues and really, frankly, what we need to do to increase college completion rates, close achievement gaps, which I know is an important issue here in the state of Minnesota. And we believe that Complete College America, that there are some very specific strategies that post-secondary institutions can employ to dramatically increase college completion rates. At Complete College America, we are an alliance of 33 states plus the District of Columbia and one of our territories, the Northern Marianas Islands, making up 35 members. And we work closely with those with state leaders in those 35 states on just a very finite number of strategies that we believe can dramatically increase college completion. And what's important to understand about these strategies is they don't the reforms that we advocate for and we discuss with state leaders don't have marginal improvements in college completion of maybe 3 or 4%, but actually get double-digit improvements in many cases, in some cases 2 and 3-fold improvements in particular metrics related to college completion. So we don't take these strategies lightly. We think that they're very important. And I think the other piece of this that's very important to understand is that any strategy that we're talking about needs to be developed and has and have been developed by faculty members, by institutions themselves, and have gotten these results. We're not talking about strategies that are theoretical, but actually have been implemented very effectively at colleges, diverse institutions with high percentages of students of color, high percentages of first-generation students. And so the many of the interventions in Representative Norton's bill, I think, speak to very much these strategies that we're very interested in pursuing and working with you on here in the state of Minnesota. Let me just very quickly walk through sort of the reasons why we think the strategies in this bill make a lot of sense for Minnesota and for college students across the country. As Representative Norton mentioned, we have a vast problem in this country with students taking far too much time to complete their post-secondary credentials, earning way too many credits, more credits than they need in order to earn a post-secondary credential, which as a result costs students money. If you're taking a semester or more or even a year's worth or more of credits that you don't need for a post-secondary credential, that obviously goes into student debt and costs students significant amounts of resources, and even more importantly, keeps them out of the workforce, keeps them in school and not out there finding a job in their field of study. And of course, one of the other key challenges, and probably the most important challenge, is that when students take too long and earn too many credits, oftentimes it creates delays in their completion, and sometimes students, particularly first-generation and low-income students, do not complete their post-secondary education, which, of course, is the bottom line. We don't want them to make this investment and then not graduate. Of course, that would be sort of the worst-case scenario for the students that we're talking about. So just very briefly, our data, we collect data from each of our states, and this is the picture that it paints, that essentially, if you're a two-year student, it takes almost 4 years for you to complete an associate's degree across the country. If you're a four-year student, it takes almost 5 years to complete, and this is for students who are at a non-selective or access-oriented four-year institutions. the number of credits that it takes. Essentially, it takes students upwards of a full semester or more, oftentimes, in terms of credits, to be able to earn a post-secondary credential, far beyond the traditional standard of 60 credits for an associate's degree and 120 credits for a bachelor's degree. And, of course, the most profound set of data is, in fact, that students oftentimes do not graduate, and our graduation rates for on-time graduation are very, very low. Only about 5% of community college students graduate with an associate's degree in 2 years, and only 18% of open access or state university students complete a bachelor's degree in 4 years. If you even add time, 150% time, so 3 years for an associate student and 6 years for a bachelor's degree student, we actually don't see much of an increase in graduation for these students. And if you're a part-time student, the likelihood you're ever going to graduate with a credential is very, very small. Hence the reason that we need to push strategies that increase credit intensity from students, if at all possible. So how do we address the challenge of low graduation rates, long times to degree? Well, actually, you know, believe it or not, there are a lot of things we can do to support students. Students come onto college campuses. They don't always know exactly what choices they should be making. There isn't a clear path for them. They oftentimes take courses that aren't related to a degree. They delay making a decision about a major. And so we actually know that a very significant portion of the cause for why students are taking too much time is because of poor support services or poor support or inadequate information about what they should be doing and enrolling in while they're enrolled in college. So at CCA, we like to talk about guided pathways to success, or GPS, just like the GPS in your car, where you set up a destination for yourself and it gives you clear directions, turn by turn, on how to get to that destination. A GPS system of academic and social and student support can actually do quite the same thing in higher education, giving students a very clear path of what they should be doing it, when they should be doing it, and a clear destination of how long it will take them to complete a credential if they take each of those steps. And so if you look at a GPS strategy for higher education, it looks very much like the bill that Representative Norton is proposing to you, which talks about creating default paths for students, giving students a clear map of what they should be taking semester by semester, and having it be a default. If you are an engineering student, you know very clearly what courses you need to be taking semester by semester. And that should be the default. You should be automatically registered in those courses and need to get permission to opt out of them. Hence the language opt out of a college schedule. Because we know that if students are given a default choice, if they've made a decision about the program and they're told very clearly what courses that they need to take, more often than not, they'll take those courses. And, of course, that reduces time to degree and ensures that the credits that they are enrolled in will actually apply to that credential. Another key component of a strategy is that we encourage students who are undecided to make an initial decision, say a meta major. So let's say I'm interested in the health sciences but don't know whether I want to be a nurse or an anesthesiologist or other types of health professions. You can make an initial choice, a health sciences meta major, and have a set of courses that you would take in your first year of study that would lead you to complete the basic requirements for those particular programs, but also help you make a decision about the ultimate program that you choose to take. An academic map is basically a semester-by-semester plan focused on 15 credits a term, ideally, so that if students take those courses, and ideally in a default schedule way, they will complete their degree on time. And then the last piece is, how do we make sure we monitor student success, making sure that those critical courses that students need to be successful are completed in the semester that they're designed to be completed, and if they're not doing well or if they're falling off track, we intervene with proactive or intrusive advising using technology tools or other means by tracking how students are performing and engaging them early before it's too late so that we can get them back on track. Just like a GPS, when you take a wrong turn, something immediately intervenes to get you right back on track. And so these strategies have proven to be very effective across the country. One last piece I want to mention before I stop is the importance of mathematics. What we're learning across the country is, indeed, students are too often asked to take college algebra. College algebra, according to math faculty now more than ever, believe that really the only reason to take college algebra is if you are planning to go into calculus or a major that requires calculus. And so, in fact, what happens is many students default into college algebra, and that's where they hit a major dead end. Mathematics is a major barrier for students in higher education. And so we advocate something a little bit different, which is for those students that indeed are following a STEM pathway, of course they should be taking college algebra, pre-calculus, and calculus. But if you're not going to be on that pathway, we should be developing alternative pathways for students. Maybe a quantitative reasoning course if you're a social sciences student or humanities student, or a statistics course is another option, and having that be the critical gateway course. Doing that actually dramatically increases student success in those math courses and allows them to enter a program of study within the first academic year. So in the end, you're looking at a system that looks a little bit like this, where a student would come on college campus, they would maybe meet with an advisor, they would make some initial choices of a meta major, maybe a STEM or a humanities or social sciences meta major, that would be aligned to the program of the mathematics courses that they need to complete. If they're not optimally prepared for that math course, maybe we would provide additional academic support to them through a prerequisite course, a remedial course that's taken at the same time as the math course. And once they get complete those initial courses, then they can make a choice into a program of study. Institutions that have done that have seen dramatic improvements in student success. Georgia State University, an open access four-year institution in Atlanta, serves a high proportion of students of color and first-generation students, has increased their graduation rates by over 20% and have closed achievement gaps completely by implementing these strategies. Florida State University has seen a dramatic increase in their graduation and retention rates and also has seen dramatic improvements in graduation from low-income students and also from students of color. So there's no question that there's evidence here in support of these models, and we have many states across the country, Tennessee, Indiana, Georgia, Illinois, Ohio, that are implementing these strategies at scale in their states right now. So we really do believe this is a great option for Minnesota. We know that MinSCU and the University of Minnesota are working hard towards college completion, and many of these strategies are already being employed on those campuses. I think what we would like to see is it done, being done in Minnesota at scale and impacting far more students than they are today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vandell. Any questions from the committee? Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question of either of these two. I just have a general question of MinSCU. I'd like to know which of the seven task forces in charting the future this is going to be used to chart the future of MinSCU. Can someone answer that?
I don't know.
I think it's fair game to talk about this now because they've resolved their differences, and I think they have it. They're charting the future. I just want to know which of the task forces we can see these bills start to be integrated into so that we would know.
And Mr. Chair, as the testifier comes down, and I don't know if she's going to answer it, or she definitely looks like she's going to make comment. I have been working with MinSCU on this plan, working toward implementing a plan, and the Office of Higher Ed as well. But I do just want to be clear, they haven't taken it to their board yet. So while the chancellor is familiar with it and his staff is familiar, I don't think they can definitively say that their board supports it. So I just wanted to be clear about that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can appreciate that, Representative Norton, and that's really not my question. My question is that if MinSCU is going to chart its future, there seems to be a disconnect between the future that we charted over the last couple of years and the one that we've discussed here, which does involve student debt, tuition. It involves the fact that we have had issues with how you are going to transfer a credit. And I think if you're going to chart the future of an entire system for the state of Minnesota, it might be a good idea to start telling us specifically where the different topics that are being brought up here are going to be integrated into these task forces. It's a relatively simple question, but if it's too complex, I can wait until another day. But I think we've been charting the future for the better part of a year. So I hope we can start to, you may have this question on a number of bills over the next few weeks.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself before you answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Representative Norton, Representative Pawlowski. My name is Linda Milne. I'm Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, and my colleagues pushed me down here to answer
the
question.
Could you repeat your name? Could you repeat your name?
I will. Linda Milne, M-I-L-N-E.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. We don't know, of course, in the reconfiguration of charting the future as it goes forward, whether the existing seven teams will retain their charges as they are right now. But I would expect, Representative Pulaski, that the Academic Planning and Collaboration Team and the Student Success Team would address this kind of work, these very topics. You probably know that the Academic Planning and Collaboration Team was assigned the work of last session's transfer pathways, multi-campus articulation agreements for baccalaureate completion, and indeed that's what that team worked on all fall.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I can appreciate that you don't know, but again, these are topics that are now taking bill form that are likely to be included in the omnibus higher education finance and policy bill. There will be something called money attached to these. So I think, and this is a suggestion, that as you begin to reconfigure how you're charting the future, you work with us this session so that we have some idea of what this charting the future is, and we never return to the debacle of the last year. You don't need to answer. That's just a statement. But I would highly suggest every time you see one of these, you tell us where it's going to work and how you're going to deal with it. Or is it just going to be another report on a shelf that you'll give to the next legislature and there will be no change at all? You don't need to answer that question either. Just an observation.
All right, thank you. One more time, any other questions from the committee? Good presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that House File 1517 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
With that,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to move on to our second bill of the day, Representative Erdahl. House File 1150. Okay. Some would like to make that motion that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill.
Almost.
Representative McDonald.
You meant likely, didn't you? Likely inclusion.
Representative McDonald makes the motion that House File 1150 be laid over for possible inclusion in our final bill. And Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. Pleased to be able to present a bill or two before you today.
Yeah, we're anxious to hear this one, 1150.
Yes, well, here we go. House File 1150 prohibits Minscu schools from requiring students to take a remedial course if they received a college-ready ACT score in that subject area. Now, as you know, the ACT is a curriculum and standards-based assessment that measures a student's academic readiness for college in four academic areas: English, reading, mathematics, science. And there is also an optional writing test. Colleges use the ACT scores for student admissions, advising, and course placement. Over 1.8 million students were tested using the ACT exam in 2014. 76% of Minnesota graduates were tested in Minnesota, over 45,000 students. Beginning with the current school year, the ACT is required of all Minnesota public high school graduates. 61% of Minnesota students achieved a college readiness score in mathematics as compared to 43% nationwide. English, 77% as compared to 64%. Reading, 56% compared to 44%. Science, 53% compared to 37%. 9,543 Minnesota students were within 4 points of achieving a college readiness score. The ACCUPLACER exam is a computer-based test that assesses reading, writing, and mathematics skills and is used in Minnesota for college course placement. ACCUPLACER testing fees vary from $20 to $75. The ACCUPLACER exam is approximately 1 hour and 45 minutes in length, but is not a timed test. By providing a waiver for students who have demonstrated college readiness, time and money will be saved. 4 in 10 who take the remedial courses in a community college course never finish the preparation courses. Many never graduate because of twists and complications can make remediation the final straw. Remediate where needed? Yes, they should. But the emphasis on this piece of legislation is don't remediate when a student has demonstrated on an ACT score that they are subject ready in a subject area.
right.
That's
all
it.
Right. You have someone with you that would like to testify?
Yes, I do.
Please identify yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Nornis, members of the committee. My name is Kenneth Abon. I am the program director for an organization called Students for Education Reform. And I would like to come up here and testify on behalf of this bill. We have been working with remedial courses extensively over the past year and a half now, and we also realize the barriers that remedial courses place for students across Minnesota. As Representative Erdahl mentioned, it is a time burden, it's a financial burden, and it's also an emotional burden, which you'll also be hearing later. So we believe that the ACT does provide an accurate measure in order to determine whether students need remedial courses or whether they can enter college level courses as is. Once you take the ACT test and you are not deemed, you don't score that 21 cut score, you should be able to take the AccuPlacer to determine whether or not remediation is the proper course of action or the proper intervention. But once you score that 21, we do believe that it is a good determinant that you will be successful in college. We know many students who have scored a 21 and had to take remediation and felt like it was a waste of their time and effort, and they aren't getting any closer to graduation. So we would ask that you support this bill today.
All right. Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions for the for Representative Erdahl, and I'm wondering what a did you say 53% for science and 56% for reading? Is that correct?
Representative Erdahl,
reading. Yes, Madam, Mr. Chair. Too many committees lately, and Representative Pugh. Reading is 56% compared to 44% nationally, and mathematics was 43%, 61% in Minnesota, 43% nationwide.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl. Those numbers are disappointingly low to me. I guess it's been a while since our kids took the tests. Is 50% the passing score? Or 50% what would be considered a passing score then?
Representative Erdahl?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I'm not sure what, maybe someone else can answer what a cut score is on an ACT test.
We thought we had an answer, apparently not. So maybe someone in the audience would know. I think we have found the answer. Welcome, and please state your name and then proceed.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paku Yang, and I am System Director of P20 and College Readiness at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We do have ACT scores, benchmarks to indicate that students are college ready. We have board policy and procedure language that says that a student who receives a 21 or higher in reading is college ready. A student who scores an 18 or higher in English is college ready. And a student who scores a 22 or higher in mathematics is college ready. These align with ACT recommendations for college readiness scores. And we do allow, if students come to us and they have met these scores, they are college level, and we place them into college level courses.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Representative Pugh.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I thank you for that. And I wasn't quite clear, so I am now. Thank you. And I'm also wondering, I have a question that maybe someone from Minsky might need to answer. I'm wondering how many students may have found themselves, say, in the last year, in this situation whereby they need to take remedial courses, and I'm wondering what the total number of courses might be, assuming that some of those students would need to take multiple courses in order then to get into the
Representative Erdahl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I've got a couple figures. I believe it's over 25% of Minnesota students must take remedial courses.
Representative Hughes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl. And so that's overall, but I'm wondering specific to Minsku in the last year, and I don't know that that 25% is reflective of Minsku specifically.
Could you answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my cheat sheet is on my desk, but what I can remember that I will say to you is within the Minnesota State Colleges and University systems, we have roughly about 18% of our students attested to developmental education with at least one level or higher.
Thank you, Ms. Yang. Representative Pugh.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So 18% mm-hmm. of the students, and again, what would that equate to in numbers? And approximately, again, how many courses might those students need to take? Mm-hmm. Just trying to get a sense for how big a problem this is.
Sure.
And that's a big number. That's a big percentage. But any more specifics that you could share with me about that would be great.
Ms. Yang.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have roughly about 410,000 students that are in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system, and about 42,000 headcount, give and take, each year. Are students who take at least one or more developmental education courses. And so, again, within this 42,000, it may just be a student taking one course versus a student that might take more than one course.
Okay. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl and Siang, you might want to wait just 1 second. When you talk about the bill disallows state or university systems to require remedial non-credit courses in a subject area if the student already tested an ACT out of that. And Mrs. Yang, you just said that if they test at an 18 in reading and 21 in science, is that what you said? Math?
21 in,
please,
Mr.
Yang.
Chair, 21 in reading, 18 in writing, and a 22 in mathematics.
Then they won't have to take remedial, right?
Sir Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are we currently requiring students above those, at or above those numbers to take to Accuplacer?
Ms. Yang.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no.
All right. Representative Erdahl?
Isaacson.
Thank you. If we're not requiring them to do that, am I missing something? Or why? What does the bill do that's different than already that's being done already?
Representative Erdahl, or... Yes, Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Isaacson. You know, I have the information I have is that, you know, there are students who are taking remedial courses who, via their ACT scores, should not have to do so. That's the information that I have.
Mr. Chair. Representative Isaacson.
Mrs. Yang, is that possible?
Ms. Yang?
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly I can't speak to every single situation that occurs
right.
at our colleges and universities. However, it is very clear that this is board policy and procedure language that every student that comes to us with ACT scores that score these level are placed into college level courses. It is when they don't have these scores that they are below that we administer the Accuplacer to see where they would place in terms of the course placement.
Representative Isaacson.
Well, I would then suggest that, I guess I'm just a little confused on what the need for the bill is at this point, because if that isn't occurring and we don't have evidence of that occurring, and I'm comfortable speaking for my school, but I think Ms. Yang can speak for Minsku in general. If we're already not doing that, I don't know that we need a law to tell us to do what we're already not to not do what we're already not doing, I guess would be my statement. Thank you.
Ms. Yang?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we expressed to Representative Erdahl that we have no concerns with this bill because it is in current practice. And so we wanted to say that we did not have concerns with it because it is something that we already institute at our institutions.
Okay, thank you. We have another response.
Mr. Chairman, actually, one of the purposes of this is to, as she said, to clarify what is presently in practice.
Mr. Is it Avon? Did I pronounce it right?
Avon.
Avon. you have a response to this.
Chair Narnas, Representative Isaacson, I would just like to add that while this may be a practice of Minsku, I also know there are many students that do not know that if they take the ACT and test out of remediation or test above 21 or 22 in the respective subject areas, that they do not need to take the Accuplacer. So perhaps there's just some education and some clarification and messaging that needs to be provided to those students who test above the 21-22 score.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
I want to make sure that I'm on the record as saying that I'm in no way defending Accuplacer on any level. So we're just clear about that. I just think that it doesn't make sense to me to have a law that reinforces what the board already said we're going to be doing, because oftentimes unintended consequences down the road of things we don't see coming, and then we got to come back and fix that, when if it's not done that way, the board's nimble enough to do it itself. But that's all I'm going to comment on. Thank you.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of just to piggyback off of that, and I actually don't know a whole lot about Accuplacer, but how often or do we know the students that would pass the ACT but then fail Accuplacer? What's kind of the difference there?
We want Minsku to come back, or someone else?
Representative Isaacson
has a reason. No, you're just pointing?
Go ahead, you do it. Go ahead.
Okay, welcome back to the committee.
Bruce Vandell, Complete College America. I could tell you that research from the Community College Research Center has found that students who take the Accuplacer, about upwards of 50% of students in mathematics that are placed into remediation after taking the Accuplacer could actually be successful on a college-level course. And so it's very uncommon, and I think the representative is referring to the fact that the Accuplacer is not a very strong assessment for really determining college readiness. So what we know is for certain, Accuplacer is not a very good tool, and students who do take it oftentimes can be successful in college-level courses.
Thank you. Any other questions? Final word, Representative Verdo.
Well, thank you for the consideration, and you know, maybe before your inclusion, we can clear a couple things up for you. And I'd like to thank Mr. Vandell here as well, who I understand spent some time living in Meeker County, and it's very obvious. Thank you.
Representative McDonald, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion.
House File 1150, laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill. Thank you very much. You want to change chairs?
Just a little variety.
Yeah, it's just change of pace. All right. We have another Berdahl bill in front of us, 982, and the chair will move House File 982 to be laid over for possible.
I have an amendment on this one, don't I?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. The A1 amendment. So I've moved the bill. Now we need to move the amendment once we know what it is.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment just, it addresses some concerns brought to me by Minsku. One of the things that this bill in its original iteration did was to require a common numbering system for courses throughout Minsku, and Minsku felt that this was a bit cumbersome and gave them some heartburn. And so I have removed those provisions.
Okay, the chair will move the A1 amendment then. Any questions? Discussion? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Now, can you explain the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 982 addresses problems with the transfer of credits for PSEO students. There seems to be inconsistency in how credits are treated. Under this bill, a high school student who receives a PSEO credit in a course taught by an accredited Minsku instructor in a Minsku class may transfer that credit to another Minsku institution. credits transfer sometimes, but they don't always. This results in a waste of revenue for the state of Minnesota and the student. It also wastes time and effort for the student. Students rely on the state. They trust that the effort put forth into a class will be rewarded. Their trust should be justified. If a student puts in time and effort and is successful, he or she should be rewarded, and the post-secondary credit should follow. They shouldn't have to negotiate. Now, a study is going to come out next month on credit transfers between second and four-year institutions. This is about PSEO, classroom in the school, and that type of thing. And I do have a testifier.
You have a testifier with you. Please state your name and then proceed.
Yes, for the record, my name is Kaylee Schoonmaker, Chair Norris, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, and the MSCSA is the association that represents over nearly 200,000 public, community, and technical college students across the state. And in recent years, our students have consistently placed three issues on the top of their policy agenda: college affordability, credit transfer, and access to and information about PSEO. And the bill before you addresses all of those issues in some manner, and we're very thankful to Representative Erdahl for bringing this legislation forward. Our association doesn't have an official position on this particular bill, but we certainly support the idea, and we did want to offer our thanks to this committee for having a discussion around the importance of PSEO and credit transfer. This is an issue we've heard about many times from our students. When a student takes a course, PSEO or otherwise, they expect it will be meaningful for them in pursuit of a college degree. And the need for this type of certainty in a student's academic pursuit has become even more critical now that the students at our public two-year institutions are paying the third highest tuition and fees in the country when compared to like institutions. Put simply, when students lose credits in transfer, it increases the cost significantly for them and delays progress toward a degree. With an increased need for well-trained workers, it's crucial for our state to have an affordable higher education system. Our public, community, and technical colleges reach every corner of this state and are accessible to everyone, making it even more crucial that students can afford to attend these institutions and go on to provide for their regional and workforce needs. The students that enter our colleges leave as our nurses, our mechanics, our police officers, our teachers, and our leaders. This legislation attempts to address the issue of students losing credits when they complete PSEO classes. If students lose credits due to transfer issues, they will be forced to retake courses, and the savings they would have otherwise realized will be negated. MSCSA continues to believe that seamless credit transfer will help students move through to a degree without unnecessary obstacles that can often discourage students from continuing their education or slow their progress and increase costs, adding to debt levels that are already often burdensome for years to come after graduation. House File 982 brings forward an important discussion, and we're really thankful to be a part of the hearing. Chair Norris, members of the committee, I want to thank you again for the opportunity to address you today, and I stand for any questions.
I may have missed it. Did you indicate where you're attending school?
Yes, I am attending both Century College and St. Paul College right now, and I'll transfer all of those back actually to Itasca Community College, where I'll graduate from.
Oh, great.
Yep, so I know all about the transfer.
Good. Well, we appreciate your testimony. Committee questions? I think you overwhelm them again, Mr. Erdahl.
One underwhelm, one overwhelm, I'm even.
Anyone in the audience care to testify on this bill? Again, what can I say? Oh, we do have a question. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. And this might be a question more for Minsku, but how does each institution decide which PSEO credits to accept? And I know it's sort of a complicated process. I've had several conversations in my office about credit transfer and so on, but if they could just sort of kind of lay out how they actually go through that process to decide if they're going to accept or not.
You want someone from Minsku to come down and answer that? You need to have the question repeated, or did you hear it clear?
No, I think I understood it.
Okay.
Do I need to identify myself again?
Yes, it would help.
I'm Linda Milne, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Chair Norris, Representative O'Neill, there is no determination of which credits they will accept. The institutions must accept credits that are brought by students, PSEO credits or any other. The sending institution determines what goal areas are accepted, and those courses, those PSEO courses, are MNSCU courses that must be accepted. The only opportunities for a non-acceptance, a legitimate opportunity, has to do not with whether the credits are accepted, but whether they apply to a given program. And those rules are according to current policy and procedure, board policy and system procedure.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. And that's what I was hearing in my office over and over again, that it's not that the credits don't transfer, it's that they don't transfer into the areas that the students think they're going to transfer into, because that bucket's already full, essentially.
Yes. All too often that happens, and I think it would go back to the topic that's come up in each discussion so far this afternoon, and that's advising. One of the things I'll note for you as a side note is that students do need good advising from the time they arrive at college, hopefully before that. And right now, we did a survey of students last year on transfer and asked them how often they sought advice or advising on transfer. And two-thirds of them said that within the last year they had consulted someone. But totally only one-third of them had consulted one of the advisors at the college. Too often they ask a friend, a family member, and don't necessarily get the help they need. So we have to do a better job in advising, I think, is the solution, we have the policy we need. We need to find ways to better inform students and better advise them.
Thank you, Ms. Milne.
Thank you, Chair.
Is that it? Okay. Okay, any other questions? If not, I'll renew my motion. The Chair renews the motion on House File 982 be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative McDonald, you can go ahead and move your motion or your
thank you, Mr. Bill. Chair. I'd like to move House File 647 for inclusion in the higher ed omnibus bill.
All right. And you can proceed.
Thank you. This is remedial day. I've actually crafted a couple questions for you regarding state government to see how many of you need remedial courses. But since Representative Pawlowski is the kind of the principal of the organization here, I won't offer those. You would, indeed. If Minnesota high school graduates are not ready for college-level coursework, is that a problem in Minnesota? With more than a quarter million high school graduates requiring remedial courses in college, it's clear that our K through 12 education system needs to be improved. In the meantime, however, students who are in college preparing to enroll in the next few years will be forced to pay millions of dollars in college tuition for remedial courses and classes, and they won't get credit for it. My bill will relieve them of that burden and increase the number of students who complete their degrees. I have a couple more questions that I will ask and then answer. Shouldn't these students just have applied themselves more in high school? That's the question I ask. Who's responsible for them to have to take remedial courses? Is it the students? Is it the teachers? Is it the parents? How about all of the above? All of the students enrolled in a college remedial courses did meet the requirements of a high school diploma. We believe that should indicate preparedness for post-secondary school. But in fact, students passed these high school classes, and many of them even aced them. And their college placement tests show that they still yet need to improve their mastery of core subjects such as math, reading, and science. What gives? Somewhere there's a problem. If these students aced it in high school, but yet in college they have to take remedial courses, we've got a problem. Other students either weren't even offered these classes, or they were dissuaded from them, and they were dissuaded for taking more rigorous courses in high school. without realizing these courses were even required to take college-level courses in many areas. Is this a continuation of achievement gap that we hear so greatly of? I think it is. Low-income students and black students are more likely, twice as likely, to be placed in remedial courses than white students, perpetuating disparities in college access and completion rates. That's not a good thing. But it affects all students of races and colors, students throughout the state, not just low income, and students of color. For example, Orono, a city out near the great city of Delano. Orono has 96% graduation rate, 5% students of color, 7% of low income students, and 19% of those Orono student graduates require at least one remedial class. Now, the achievement gap has many causes. This bill, by no means, is the silver bullet. Is there ever any evidence that co-requisite classes and this approach works? Yes. You will see it by Mr. Van Dale. He was before you just earlier with Representative Norton's bill. He has some facts and some data that substantiate other states that have, including these remedial courses or co-requisite courses, are working and lowering the student debt and allowing these students to graduate on time. How does co-requisite work? I'm glad you asked, Chairman. Co-requisites are credit-bearing college-level courses that incorporate the academic supplemental support. For example, a student who needs additional support in English could take a credit-bearing history course designed to also improve that student's English course and his skills. The supplemental support could come in forms of tutoring, online institution, or various other means. What if the students aren't ready for college-level coursework, even with the co-requisite approach? That is a problem, and it does happen. For those students who need more significant support than is offered through the co-requisite model, they can enroll in what looks like a traditional remedial course. But instead of the student paying for that service, the remedial course will be provided through adult basic education, which our taxpayers already pay for, and it's available to them for free. But they can access this additional support. Oh, I said that already. See, I did a little ad-libbing there on that one. So they can already have access to these adult basic education if they're not ready for the college coursework and the remedial courses in college. And what will the students pay for these supplemental courses? Nothing. They've already paid for it in the adult basic education through their tax dollars. I had a discussion with Minskew, and they have some concerns with this bill. I fully recognize it. I met with these good folks up here, and I'm willing to continue to work on the bill so it has an answer for all, but yet really gets to the bottom line is helping the student graduate and in less debt. I'm going to turn it over to my witness, Mr. Van Dale, and he will continue some of the expert witness and some of the other areas that states are working on that will remedy this situation.
Mr. Van Dale, welcome back to the witness seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Indeed, this issue of remediation is a profound issue across the country. Our data that we've collected, and really the general consensus, is that about 60% of new entering community college students require some form of remedial education. So let's be clear. If you take the population of students who are brand new to the institution and those that are enrolling in courses that initial semester, about 6 out of 10 community college students across the country require remediation. I would encourage you to take a close look at what those data are in the Minskew system. We also know that about only 1 in 10 students who are placed into remedial education ever actually earn a college credential within 200% time. So if it's a community college student, it would be 8 years. A four-year student would be 8 years and 6 years for a community college student. But the bottom line is that students who enter remediation are admitted to remediation, rarely get out of the remedial courses, and ultimately maybe never even graduate. In fact, about 70% of students across the country that are placed in remedial mathematics never actually ever reach a college-level math course. So why is that? Actually, the reason why students are not successful in remediation has to do with the fact that, and there was one of the representatives referring to this earlier, is that we've developed long sequences of courses that students must take before they enter a college-level course. In mathematics or in English, sometimes it's 1, 2, 3, 4 or more semesters of remedial courses that students do not receive credit for, that they have to pay for out of their own pocket, that goes towards their student loan, that requires them to take student loans, etc. So the bottom line is that when you put students in those extra courses, what you're doing is extending the amount of time that they need to be in college and reducing the likelihood that they will complete college. So this visual gives you a sense of that. For every 10 students who are enrolled in remedial mathematics and are placed upwards of 3 levels or 3 classes below college level, only about 1 in 10 actually ever complete a college level course. But what's really interesting is that the reason for that is not that they failed the course or they weren't capable of learning the material, but they just dropped out of the system. They may have finished the first course but then didn't enroll in the second. Or they might have even completed all of the remedial courses but then never enrolled in the college level course. So this problem of student attrition is really the heart of the matter. In fact, that is sort of the prevailing wisdom now in the research, is that it's because of the attrition from semester to semester. That's the main reason why students are not completing college-level courses. And the same is true in English. So that is why at Complete College America, we have identified and worked with institutions, and many institutions have implemented these co-requisite strategies by placing students into college-level courses and providing them the support they need while enrolled in those courses, just as the representative described. But we would be more specific about what your objective here is. Basically, as we look at the research from the Community College Research Center, MDRC, and others have found that it's critical that students get through gateway college courses within one academic year. So whatever strategy that you employ, you should ensure that students are passing their gateway courses, whether that be a college-level math course or English course, and then entering a program of study within that first year of study. Doing so maximizes students' likelihood of graduating with a post-secondary credential. The longer it takes a student to enter a program of study, the less likely they'll graduate. So there are many different ways that you can go about this. And so there's no limitation, there's no one way to do it, and the representative made reference to this. You can add extra time onto a course, maybe an extra hour or two to a course within a semester and provide that additional support. You can require a lab or mandatory tutoring. You can even sequence the instructions. So for the first couple weeks of the semester, you work through the remedial content and then accelerate them through the college level course within the same semester. Those single semester models are highly effective. And here are just a couple of examples. The Community College of Baltimore County eliminated a remedial education course, placing students directly into the college level course and then delivering academic support while during the same semester. In the old model, where they had students take a prerequisite English class, only about 33% were passing college level math or English courses. Now over 75% are completing college level courses. At Austin Peay State University in Tennessee, the results in mathematics particularly are dramatic, where in the old model, students would have to take 2 semesters of remedial mathematics before accessing the college-level course. Under the old model, only about 10% of students were completing college-level math courses. Now, upwards of 65 to 80% of students are completing college-level math courses in a single semester. So the whole idea of eliminating those attrition points is essential to understanding how to support students and have them be successful in college-level courses. There are other models that take 2 semesters. So if students maybe need additional support beyond maybe a 1 semester, you could put them into a 2-semester model, still ensuring that the student completes the college-level course within an academic year. So maybe the first semester you would weave together college-level material and remedial material, and then the second semester take the college-level course with additional support, ensuring your success in the college-level course. And the Carnegie Foundation has implemented this model across the country and has seen dramatic increases in the percentage of students who are passing college-level courses using this model. So there is really very little question that the co-requisite model is successful, and so successful, in fact, that the states you see before you, West Virginia, Tennessee, Connecticut, Colorado, Indiana, and others, have committed to implementing co-requisite remediation at scale in their states right now. And the results are extremely impressive. So Indiana, who's implementing at scale co-requisite for all students who are placed into remedial mathematics and remedial English, in their quantitative reasoning mathematics courses. In the old model, they had about 29% of students completing college-level mathematics in 3 years. Now, they have over 64% of students completing college-level mathematics in one semester. So it's it really does demonstrate the likelihood that if students are in a co-requisite model, they're going to get through college-level courses and ultimately move forward with their program of study. Similar results in English and reading. Another important point that I want to make is that last year, the legislature here in Minnesota passed a bill to require that all students take the suite of ACT college prep exams that indeed provide an indication to high school students on whether or not they're on track to be college ready. And as a result of that, provides opportunities for high schools to be more involved in preparing students for the specific skills they need to be successful in college-level work. We think that's an important piece of legislation that you've passed and really dovetails nicely with the co-requisite strategy. If, in fact, students in high school are receiving additional support, are being assessed on their readiness while still in high school, and there's interventions there, there really is no reason why a high school graduate in Minnesota should not be placed in anything more than a co-requisite instructional model. And so doing so, combining those two pieces of the puzzle, really creates an exciting model for both K-12 and higher education working together to ensure that students are successful in higher education. So we're very excited about this piece of legislation and are very interested in how we can support this work here at Complete College America.
Thank you very much, Representative McDonald. Well, we have, I believe, Representative Isaacson, do you have a question?
Several.
Several, okay. Let's go with question number one.
So, Representative McDonald, you and I have spoke about this, and I am on the bill, and I will say that, in general, I have a very sincere and philosophical dislike of non-credit courses. I think that they're not helpful, and I think that they have a negative effect on students, and I see it in my own classrooms when I talk to them about the courses they're taking and getting them ready. and I really support the idea of what we're trying to accomplish here. However, I have to push back on a couple of things. Attrition because of remedial courses is not accurate. Attrition is going to occur in our schools, and when you're talking about students who are less ready, we shouldn't be surprised that they might have a higher attrition rate. So I'm not ready to go as far as to say that it's because of remedial courses. And what I'm struggling with is that we have identified, I think, a pretty significant and important problem, and it really can take us down many avenues, right? One avenue could be, when you touched on this, was it the parents, was it the schools, was it the environment, was it the student, and it's probably some combination of all of them that are responsible. We're not in a situation at the school that we can go back and fix what happened before, nor can we charge a cost, I think, to K-12. I think that wouldn't be the right thing to do. But it doesn't mean any less likely that we have these students in our midst. And so how do we fix the problem? And I feel like what I would hope we'd do with this bill, because I believe that we need to do something about it, is that we take away this kind of mallet approach where we're going to just stamp a new idea down that I don't know that works well for us on two levels. One, I'm not comfortable coming back to Minsky and asking them to foot the bill on this because I think we're already strapping them enough. And so I believe that, and I've spoke to you about putting an amendment set forth at some point that's going to have some outside additional funding to cover the cost of this to make sure we don't create a problem that way. But I think, too, there's a more nuanced problem here that when you're looking at remedial students, you know, in my classes at Century, I've had ranges of students. I've had students that have never used Microsoft Word or email before, and I have students that clearly should be in an Ivy League school before. So I've seen a range of them, and I think that range isn't lost on just the remedial folks, that there are probably truly some people that really just need, no doubt, to go to a course that's going to be just for them, that is not at a college level. The fact that that happens and may be necessary is the reality that I'm willing to accept. But I bet there's another large portion of them that don't need that, but just need a little bit of support in the classroom beyond, right? And so I feel like rather than legislating with a mallet, if we could legislate with a scalpel on that respect and try to be a little bit more specific would be super helpful. And I'm just interested in your thoughts on both the idea of how we're going to pay for this, because I don't think it'd be the right thing to do to go back to Minsky and say, on top of all the things we're having you paid for and what we're and the money we're going to either give you or not give you, we want you to cover this expense too. By the way, we know it's not your fault, but it's in your lap, so you got to fix it. So how are we going to pay for it? And if you agree with this idea that we need might need appropriate money for it. And the second thing is if you're open to the idea down the road of really nuancing this a little bit more and understanding that maybe what we need to do is give the school the flexibility to manage when someone needs just some help versus someone who truly needs. Like the students that never used Microsoft Word before and haven't, I'm not quite sure how they got in, but haven't been in that situation, that's a legit concern, right? But the other students, I think that it's more nuanced than just saying one remedial or not remedial. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on both of those.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, in the bill, it does offer Minscu to help formulate and scope how these cohort requisite classes would be. So it does give them the authority and that it should be. I don't think it should be our job to mandate and to cultivate that program, what that looks like. I certainly encourage them to look at models that we have that deal with cohort requisite, but it does give them the opportunity to draft it together and implement it within their schools. While I agree with you, and you and I talked with this, and so did I with the Minscu, in the example of a student that's been far removed from school for 10 years plus, that's going back for a degree, that person would take remedial courses because he hasn't taken math, or she, in 10 plus years, math, reading, or science. So who pays for that is the question. Well, who's the customer? Customer is the student. We'll recognize that the bill has some areas that I think are problematic when it comes to Minscu and who pays the bill. So I sought out that question, and I came to some answers by experts and those who are in the know that through adult basic education, which is a program that, of course, we taxpayers pay for, are available for all students who are maybe that far removed from education, from math and science. And they can take those courses free, ready to go, and not have to take them in colleges where it costs them money and or where, if this bill is passed, requires Minscu to pay for it, but it gives them that ability to take it. Now, one, they get it for free, but they don't get credit for that. So that's a little problematic if that's the strategy that we would go for. So, but, you and I visited with this, and I recognized that who pays the bill? Should you build a school back because they didn't educate it? But I think you were looking at two different classifications of students, one that's right out of high school and one that's 10 years removed.
Representative Isaacson?
Yes, thank you.
I'm not sure I'd be quite as prescriptive in the classification because I have students right out of high school that have the same academic level as some of those students that haven't been around for a while. And I think that in terms of who pays for it, my concern would be when you think of how the per-credit model works at Minscu, and we have students that would normally be taking a remedial course and their credit that they're paying for pays for that remedial course. When we put them in a classroom where they're already paying credit to a professor that's already there by adding a second professor or teacher there, we're not accounting for the cost of that teacher. And so one of the ways that I think that we'd have to look at that is finding a way to provide additional revenue for that particular cost. And I know you and I might philosophically disagree a little bit on this, but in my mind, for me, my vision of how this works for our committee is what do we do to remove barriers to get kids into school or adults into school so they become productive members of society and more fulfilled and have jobs. And so if we have folks that are sitting in that spot that aren't able to pass those classes without doing a remedial and we can put them in a situation to be successful, it seems like it'd be encumbered upon us to provide that additional funding in a classroom that now they're getting the normal credit plus some extra help, because I think that only benefits everybody in the long run. I mean, I think that's a really solid use of taxpayer dollars. The other option would be, of course, is that if you're in a remedial class, you charge them more because they're getting additional assistance. But I think that comes back to the idea of student debt, and I'm not so sure that's the best way to go either. So I hope that you'll be open to that conversation as we move forward, and maybe we can find a solution that allows for us to get rid of some way, get rid of the non-credit courses, or at least remove their prevalence as much and maybe find a more nuanced solution. But I think that we're on the right track.
Representative, you have a comment to Representative McDonald?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Isaacson. I recognize your concerns, and I share those concerns as well and willing to craft what's necessary, I think, as we continue. Nothing's perfect. There's no silver bullet. but I appreciate your concern. And just to be honest, well, not to be dishonest, right? Such a silly statement. Well, to be honest, no, I shared that with Minsk, who shared their concerns, and I recognize that, and I think it's very legit. But I will defer maybe to Mr. Vandell, that with his expert opinion, he might be able to shed a little light on this as well. Mr. Vandell?
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chairman, so yes, obviously the question of cost is always an issue. I can tell you that in a couple of different ways that this has been studied. Indeed, you know, any time that you're talking about a reform, there might be some upfront costs. But the research that's been done by the university in North Carolina that have implemented many of these models have found that, indeed, the cost per completion is much lower in a co-requisite model by placing more students in college-level courses. And in fact, there are many different models out there that are cost-effective approaches to delivering co-requisite. In fact, a good example is the Community College of Baltimore County model, which is called ALP, has been adapted in over 200 institutions across the country in many number of ways to deal with the specific circumstances within a college and what cost limitations that they're under. So you shouldn't presume that there's a specific cost to delivering co-requisite in an additional way. It's been implemented in any number of different ways under many different cost structures, some very efficiently, and generally speaking and consistently gotten very, very good results. Having said that, I mean, there's obviously questions about resources that you always have to consider in these discussions. But the other piece of this that you have to keep in mind also is retention rates. Students that are able to graduate actually stay enrolled, and in these models, they stay enrolled, they're retained at a higher rate. That generates tuition dollars for the institution as well. And so actually, in many cases, that actually there's been some cost savings, not only cost savings, but they've generated revenue through tuition with higher tuition rates using these approaches.
Representative Chris Isaacson, did you have a comment to follow up on that?
I'm not sure that that. I mean, of course, they had less cost. They're less courses, right? And so, what that doesn't count for is the fact that in each of those courses, you're requiring an extra teacher, which means that there might be less cost to the student, which is a good thing. It's not less cost to the university that's got to pay for that. And so, I'm not sure that exactly answers what we're discussing here.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly to clarify, there are many models that don't have two faculty in the room. So there are models that use laboratory settings, using graduate assistants, teaching assistants, and other types of groups, students, even undergraduate students that are providing instruction and tutoring that are used, that are very effective. Doesn't require necessarily that you have two faculty in the room.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So I apologize because I was out of the room for a few minutes, but did you have some sort of a financial cost calculated into this, Representative McDonald, as far as, I know it's probably not a fiscal note per se, but the MNSCU kind of let you know what kind of cost they would be incurring if they had to pay for all of this remedial work for students since they're open enroll and they have to take everybody, and have they expressed any dollar figures or anything like that?
McDonald?
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Neill, I want to thank you. First of all, you're the one that brought to my attention some of the concerns of the bill in regards to the monies and how who would pay and how that would follow. So I want to acknowledge that that you brought that to my attention. It was helpful in my research. I do not have a fiscal note on the bill, nor has MNSCU shared with me the cost. They did share with me there would be a cost, but not an amount.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Unless MNSCU wants to come and express their concerns.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have two testifiers that traveled here from great distance who would like to share their stories. They promised me it would be brief, if you would should allow. We have Ms. Gandy and Ms. Carr.
Oh. Before we get to that, I have Representative Rosenthal who has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this actually is for Mr. Vandell. I, too, Representative McDonald, I appreciate what you're trying to do as well, but I am concerned, like Representative Isaacson, with the cost to the institutions, in my instance, Normandale Community College. But you've listed off all these other states, so I assume they're doing something. What are they doing, and how are they addressing this issue?
Mr. Vandell?
West Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Colorado, Indiana, Nevada, and Texas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so yeah, every institution in every state is handling it in a different way. They basically have said, set two parameters in terms of how campuses will implement these models. One is that they will deliver instruction as a co-requisite and ensure that students will complete college-level courses or give the opportunity to complete college-level courses within one academic year. Within that framework, each institution is allowed to develop the model that works best for their institution, identifying the resources that they have available. Depending on the state, some of these states have what they call performance-based funding, so that they actually get resources from their legislature, from their state, if they actually hit certain metrics related to the success of students in remediation. So that would be the case in Indiana and Tennessee. Others don't have those models, but have made a commitment and have recognized that it's an important model. Like West Virginia, there's no additional funding available in West Virginia in order to support these models, but they are providing support at the state level in terms of professional development and allowing flexibility for each institution to implement the model that they can best implement within their existing resources. So it depends on the state. It really does depend.
We have uncovered a fiscal note.
Says who? Nice going, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. If members would like to have that just briefly, I guess, give an overview. Fiscal analyst Ken Savory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll run through this very quickly, not to belabor any points, but based on the fiscal note we received back about a week ago, the biennial total for the 16-17 biennium for this bill is approximately $17 million, and the 18-19 outline years are approximately $33 million. This includes both impact on the expenditure side, so the amount it would cost the bill, and both the fee and departmental earnings, which would be the revenue which Minsky would receive via tuition. So there are those cost issues that do exist.
Okay, thank you. Representative McDonald, you said you have three other testimonies?
Just two witnesses, sir.
Two others?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Would you like to call them down at this
time? I would. Ms. Vandy and Ms. Carr.
Hello, Chair Nornis and members of the committee. My name is Latasha Gandhi, and I'm the Managing Director for Students for Education Reform. ESPRN is an organization made up of college students fighting for the educational outcomes for students in our community. I myself started off as a student in the organization and was a student at Metropolitan State University, a Minsky institution, where I took remedial courses as well. We are here today to express our support for House File 647. I want to start by thanking our chief author, McDonald, and the Minsky Faculty Union, and many others for working on this issue and keeping the conversation open. As members of the community and ESFR, we feel this bill is vital to increasing graduation rate, retention, and managing the cost and emotional burden students carry when they need to take remedial courses. We acknowledge that there are variations among the Minsky schools, and therefore we intentionally try to leave it open and broad, and leave the board directed to accommodate the variations among their different demographics, age, and geography. In many places, Minsky is running great programs, and we want to see them utilized across the board, no matter where the student is able to access the school. And it's important, regardless of where they access the school. Passing this legislation also not only supports students to be successful academically, but is also a key step to decreasing college debt, making every course a student takes meaningful, and improving the economic and social well-being of our community. Minsky Faculty Union and ESPR have concern about this piece of legislation, not supporting students who are too far behind for co-requisite to work. Therefore, the bill includes a section where those students are supported in traditional remedial courses at no cost to the student. So we're working with Minsky Faculty Union to ensure all students are receiving a differentiated amount of support based on their need. There is also concern around the cost to implement this legislation. And we have again been working with Minsky Faculty Union to work towards some sort of solution. The companion to this bill in the Senate allows for students to be charged 50% of one credit if they access the co-requisite model. It is our hope that this fee will offset the cost that Minsky would incur for implementing this model. I want to pass it over to T.R. Carr now, who is a student and member of ESPR, for her to share her personal experience in taking remedial courses.
Welcome. If you could state your name for the committee and then proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is T.R. Carr,
and I'm 18 years old, and I'm a second semester student at Simba College. I'm also the chapter leader of Students for Education Reform at Simba College, and today I want to share with you my story of how I ended up here. When I was in fourth and fifth grade, I realized I was behind my classmates in reading. It was a very difficult process, but I fought all through elementary and middle school to catch up in reading, and some of the writing challenges I faced with the support of my teachers. Fast forward to junior year of high school, my parents moved us back to St. Paul, remembering how I felt in fourth and fifth grade. I did not want to fall behind again with the change in school. I made sure that I was in college level classes. I took IB, International Baccalaureate classes, my junior and senior year to make sure that I would not fall behind. As I started to think about life after high school, I wanted to do everything in my power to become a strong candidate to enter college. I worked to become president of the Keystone of the Eastside Boys and Girls Club, and through my efforts, I was even given the title of Youth of the Year for the Eastside of St. Paul. I was doing well in and outside of school, and when I moved back to Woodbury for the last half of my senior year, English felt like a breeze. As I was getting ready for college, I took the ACCUPLACER test that tested my level of entering college. Then I found out when I got into college that I would have to take two semesters of remedial writing. I wondered why would I have to take two semesters of remedial writing. I wondered why I would have to do that when I was on track taking IB classes throughout my 2 years of high school. I intentionally took those steps to be prepared for college. I tried very hard in school. I got good grades. I even spent some Wednesdays and countless Sundays in the library doing homework, reading, writing, and making sure that I understood my material. Now I have to spend two semesters of my college career being exactly where I feared I'd be, behind. Is that my fault? While this was difficult for me to accept emotionally, I faced an even harsher financial reality. Because of my unique circumstances at home, I am only eligible for unsubsidized loans. I do not get any grants, and I only get a certain amount of financial aid. Now I have to use loans and financial aid for courses that are not getting me any closer to graduation. I am already working a full-time job to meet financial needs. How am I going to be able to pay for school once my financial aid runs out? And because I had to apply them to my college courses that aren't getting me any closer to becoming a college graduate. I want to become a college graduate, but because my financial aid will not be able to cover both remedial courses and my general requirements for college, I may not be able to. After working so hard, I do not want to have to give up because I'm not able to afford paying for both remedial courses and my general college courses. While this is only my story, it is one of many. Students across the state are working hard and doing what they need to do to get to college and earn a college degree to fulfill their life's dreams. However, once they get to college, they are faced with the financial aid and emotional burden of taking remedial courses when they originally thought they were ready for college. We are asking you all to support this bill today because students like myself are asking for extra support once they get to college to gain the skills we need to be successful in college rather than place us in a class that not only eats up our time but eats up our money. We need co-requisite courses because it gives us a better chance to realize our dream, not only getting into college, but getting through college.
Thank you very much. Thank you for also taking on the leadership role that you have. Are you in a two-year program, four-year program, or what is your intent?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, I go to Samuel College, so I'm getting my associate's in HR.
Members, questions? Well, to both of you, thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Representative McDonald, we're coming to the conclusion here, I think.
Good.
Any other witnesses in the audience who would like to testify? I guess we have a couple of heads nodding. So come on down. Welcome back. State your name again, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paku Yang, and I am System Director of P20 and College Readiness at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We have appreciated Representative McDonald discussing this bill with us, and I appreciate this opportunity to provide comments on House File 647. Across the nation, there is a movement to improve how higher education supports students in developmental education. In Minnesota and in Minsku, we are equally committed to ensuring that our students needing remediation get the support that they need in efficient and effective ways to meet their academic, transfer, or graduation goals. At Minsku, we encourage a variety of evidence-based approaches to be used, and our institutions develop programs based on their local needs. Many of our Minsku institutions are utilizing various models and programs to limit time to degree and lessen the financial impact for students needing developmental education. Some examples of these models include accelerated approaches. A few of our institutions are doing the Community College of Baltimore program, the ALP. Contextualized learning, modularized instruction, early assessments, and we are using multiple measures. We do have a couple of institutions that are currently using the supplemental academic instruction model, and their data thus far has shown promising results. Because of our open access mission, Minsku colleges and universities serve a wide continuum of students from all walks of life, as we've had conversations already today. Overall, we support the autonomy of our institutions to develop and implement multiple research-based and data-driven models that have shown promising results based on local needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else care to testify?
Yes, of course.
State your name, please. And,
yes. My name is Shirley Johnson. I am a faculty member at North Hennepin Community College. I teach in our academic development department. I'm also faculty association president.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laurel Watt. I teach reading at Inver Hills Community College in Inver Grove Heights.
We are here today, first of all, our two goals are, we want, first of all, to speak to House Bill 647, as Paku has sort of indicated as well. Our two goals are really to speak specifically to what it is that we are doing within our institutions, and also to express some level of concern related to House Bill 647. Certainly, Mr. Chairman, we recognize and really thank you for your efforts in learning about what's going on at Fergus Falls. I know that you have had very targeted conversations with faculty at Fergus Falls, and know that on any occasion, particularly perhaps a Valentine's Day breakfast with Kent, you had an opportunity to learn about the impact that this bill might have on us and our institutions.
I just want to add that when you have neighbors,
yes,
like the one you mentioned, living pretty close by, you do communicate often.
Yeah. And I should clarify that the Valentine's Day breakfast was in no way, shape, or form romantic.
Yes,
it was, all right.
Thank you very much for that.
What we'd like to do is really sort of educate you and also tell you a little bit about what's going on at our institutions so that you have a better idea of how to make informed choices about how we can perhaps, to use Representative Isaacson's language, take a scalpel to it. Having done considerable research on this area, both Laurel and I have come to the conclusion that when you look at best practices, they really fall into three major categories, those being prerequisite models, acceleration, and issues related to assessment. And so I'd like Laurel, if you could just kick us off with accelerate or with prerequisite.
Ms. Watt?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have to say I'm really grateful for this opportunity to share with you what we are actually doing, especially in developmental reading on the two-year campuses. Listening to all of this testimony here today just underscores my belief that we need to be better communicators about what we actually do in the classroom, and I think we also need to share with you who our students actually are. First of all, I'll give you an example of what co-requisite instruction means at Inver Hills Community College. About 40% of the students who take the ACCUPLACER get an initial placement into developmental reading and writing. So on the first test is about 40% of our students. All of them are encouraged, sometimes strongly encouraged, to retake the test before enrolling. I've got some data I'll give you on that in just a minute. But of those 40% who place into developmental reading and writing, the majority of them are being asked to take one semester of developmental. And you notice I don't use the word remedial. I can explain that later. But we call it developmental reading. The majority of them are taking one semester, and we offer a lot of learning communities at Inver Hills. We've been doing a learning community program since 2006, I think it is. And so these students who are placing in a single semester of developmental reading and writing have the option of taking those as standalone courses, or they can take those courses in a learning community. And I'm doing two of those this semester, and I think that'll give you an example. In both of these learning communities I'm teaching in this semester, I'm teaching a three-credit developmental reading course. It's called Reading College Text. And those students are also in a developmental writing course for 3 credits, and they're also taking a college-level course. In one learning community, they take Introduction to Sociology. The other learning community, those students are enrolled in Interpersonal Communication. The textbook for the Interpersonal Communication class and the textbook for the Sociology class, those are the textbooks for the reading classes. We don't use any sort of standalone, discrete reading instruction. We're using the texts, the readings, the materials of those college-level classes. That's what co-requisite instruction means to developmental reading faculty across the system, especially on the two-year campuses. We've been doing this, as I said, for several years, and we're pretty happy with the results so far. We find that students who take those courses, again, it's a single semester of developmental reading and a developmental writing course, students who take those courses in learning communities succeed at higher rates, we have a higher success rate, and higher retention rates. So we think we're doing the right thing. Shirley can tell you a little bit about what they do at North Hennepin.
All right.
Ms. Johnson.
At North Hennepin, we offer a paired course, and it's very similar to the learning community model. Basically, I teach intermediate level developmental reading class that is paired with a sociology class. My job, as it relates to the the students that are enrolled in this class, is to teach the skills and strategies that they will need to comprehend the sociology material. And so basically what I think Laurel and I are both expressing is the need for contextualized reading, contextualized reading strategies taught by people who understand the reading process and who are fully trained in the pedagogy of reading. This is somewhat different from more generic forms of supplemental instruction where you might have a content area tutor or a semi-professional tutor or a student who's been successful in a class tutoring them on the content of the material. I would suggest to you that in no way, shape, or form are those individuals prepared to do what it is that we are capable of doing because we focus on process. There are other schools. Century, for example, is currently providing tutors that are linked specifically to classes. And those tutors are embedded within the classes, and then they provide small group study sessions related to that.
We have, if I can interrupt, we have a question, I think, at this time, Representative Christensen.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if you believe there are students that are too far behind to benefit from a co-requisite course.
Yes.
Ms. Johnson?
I can speak specifically to that at North Hennepin. What we do is work closely with our advising team, and basically the students that are best prepared to succeed in the paired course model are those that are at the higher end of the ACCUPLACER scores. We do have alternative models available for students that are at the middle or lower end as well, and those are standalone models.
Follow-up, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if, I think Representative McDonald spoke earlier about adult basic education. Do you ever refer someone to adult basic education to prepare themselves?
Ms. Johnson or Ms. Watt?
You could go.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, most of the two-year campuses have some sort of relationship with adult basic education. But one thing that you may or may not know is that across the system, we don't really have what we call a floor. You know, we established in 2008 in system policy 3.3.1 that a student had to get a 77.5 on the ACCUPLACER to be considered college ready to go into college English, for example. But there was never the other end established, as it were. Some campuses, if a student scores below 40, might be referred to adult basic education. For others, it's 35. It depends on where you are in the state and what kind of relationship you have with your local adult basic education unit. The thing about adult basic education is when you refer students to adult basic education, they hardly ever come back. So I think a lot of the two-year campuses are reluctant to do that, because especially in math, if you're referring them to ABE for math, you almost never see them again. The other thing I want to say about adult basic education, you know, we love those people. We know them on our campus. You know, we have a relationship with them. But they don't know the faculty that I work with, that person who teaches interpersonal communication in my learning community, that person who teaches sociology. Those are my colleagues. I know how they lecture. I know how they test. I know what I have to prepare students to do. I'm not teaching students how to read. I'm teaching students how to read college-level materials and how to retain information and how to take tests and how to take those tests by those instructors. So there are limits to what we can ask of adult basic education.
What we also find is that there are some institutions that actually have ABE on campus. There's not a lot of them, but there are some. We happen to have an alliance with Osseo, and we have a program called College Prep that is available at North Hennepin. It is not distinctly ABE from the standpoint that students, the goal of College Prep really is to ease students into the community college system. I think the other piece of the puzzle that sometimes gets neglected relative to adult basic education, as Laurel indicated, I think we all have good relationships with the ABE programs, but part of the issue as well is context. I think the other piece of the issue is getting them on campus, getting them familiar with the campus environment, are all essential pieces of that puzzle. It's not something that where you just send them away and, you know, give them some instruction and bring them back. That link is broken.
We're nearing the end of our committee time. Representative Pugh, we have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a real quick question. This 40% number is so concerning to me.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if any consideration has been given to inviting juniors who are considering attending a two-year college to sit for the test while they still have a year in high school to consider, you know, redefining what their senior year is going to look like.
Yes.
I just think it might be an opportunity.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, I believe there are a lot of campuses that are already doing that. There are a lot. I mean, our campus has done it in the past, and I'm not the best person to ask about the details about how many high schools and how many students test and so forth, but I know that our assessment person has been going out to high schools, and they've done this fairly regularly in the past. Now, I did want to give you this information because you asked about it before. something that we did on my campus several years ago, and it was the reading faculty who instigated this. We said, can we please have a policy so that when students place into the lower tier, and by the way, most of you may or may not know that when we talk about developmental reading and writing on most of the two-year campuses, we're really dealing with two tiers of students, okay? And that top tier, as Shirley said, those are the ones that can really benefit from co-requisite instruction, for example, the learning communities that I was mentioning earlier. That lower tier is a more challenging population, but also there's a high error rate sometimes with the ACCUPLACER. And so what we did on my campus is we said, can we require them to take the test a second time? And they decided we couldn't require it, but what happens is if a student on my campus gets that lower tier reading writing placement, they are strongly encouraged, urged, we plead, cajole, whatever, please come back and take the test on a second day. And what I want to share with you is that of the students who do come back, and it's a problem because we can only get about a quarter of them to actually come back and take the test a second time, but of the ones who do, two-thirds of them manage to get a higher placement when they take the test a second time. So this is clearly a best practice that we do at Inver Hills. We've been doing it for several years. And in one case, I'll give you this example. This is from fall of 2012. We had 90 students who originally got that lowest placement. They came back, they retested, and of the 90 retests, 49 of them moved up one level, and 11 of them went all the way to college ready. They went all the way to freshman composition just by taking the test a second time. So this is why when, you know, Shirley said earlier, there's really three things that you need to know. First of all, we totally buy into co-requisite instruction, and we're putting students in linked classes and learning communities whenever we can. But we've got a bunch of other students that, to be honest, they're scoring consistently at the 25th percentile and below on the ACCUPLACER. They're reading at an eighth grade level. They're going to struggle with college level work. And supplemental instruction is not going to work for them because they need focused reading and writing instruction. And I just have to say about supplemental instruction, it's a co-requisite practice, and it's good. But there are barriers to scaling it up, even on a single campus, let alone across the system. Like at Century College, they use tutors linked to classes, which is a type of supplemental instruction. It's very effective. We've done it on a small scale at Inver Hills. It's effective, but here's the thing. When you do supplemental instruction, especially on a two-year campus, you are relying on student tutors, and they are a very much a finite resource. You have a small pool of labor in which, you know, we can draw. And many students are recommended to be peer tutors, but very few of them are willing and able. They have families, they have jobs off campus, and their first priority is their own course load. So we struggle just to hire competent peer tutors, and we're lucky to hang on to them for two semesters, because after two semesters, they're transferring to the University of Minnesota or wherever. So my concern about the bill, with its very prescriptive focus on one type of co-requisite instruction, is I don't know who's going to do the work. We, right now on my campus, we have no engineering tutor. We have no tutor for one of the biology courses. We have no tutor for the paralegal program. We have no geology tutor. So we're struggling just to find peer tutors for those courses. I can't imagine, you know, supplemental instruction, what it means, like Shirley said, that peer tutor, that student tutor has to be in that class, attending the class with the rest of the students, and then they're typically running something like 5 hours a week of review sessions. And you also have to have classrooms, and some of us don't have the classrooms.
We want to thank you for your testimony. We're past our committee time.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Representative McDonald, would you care to come back? And I'm sure you have at least a 15-second wrap-up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the discussion is afoot, and much work needs to be done, and I'm willing to continue to work with you, Mr. Chairman, as you consider this for the omnibus bill and work to improve it for the students, to change the 40% needing remedial, and to help with who pays for it and help our great colleges of Minsku. I'm a result of two of their colleges, so I mean no financial ill to them.
Right.
We have work to do, and I think we can close this gap. With that, I renew my motion of House File 647 for possible inclusion into the higher ed omnibus bill.
Very good. And a thank you to all of the testifiers today, and our committee is adjourned.